Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email onair at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
It's Wednesday, the 4th of July. Welcome to your nightly news and current affairs show, The Informer. I'm your host, Tom Morgan. Tonight on the show, we look at data released this week, which shows that we are not doing enough to combat rates of HIV transmission in our Indigenous communities. We find out about the Channel's new round of grants for diverse storytelling, offering four grants of $2,500 for projects that support members of the LGBTIQA+ communities in Australia to tell their stories and have their voices heard. And we find out how drag helped Madeleine McKenzie realise her true self as a transgender woman as she returns to the spotlight at the recent Cancer is a Drag fundraiser.
This is The Informer, Joy's nightly news and current affairs program. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS us on 0427 Joy 949, email onair at joy.org.au or add us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
New data has urged that it's time for immediate action to combat HIV amongst Indigenous Australians, with the news that newly diagnosed HIV rates amongst Australian-born non-Indigenous people decreased by 22% from 3.7 per 100,000 in the population to 2.9 per 100,000 in the population between 2012 and 2016. But there is a 33% increase in new cases of HIV diagnosis in Indigenous people, from 4.8 per 100,000 people in 2012 to 6.4 in 2016. An article in the Medical Journal of Australia released this week shows that the rates of HIV diagnosis amongst Indigenous Australians is more than double the rate for non-Indigenous people for the first time since the full data was collected in 1992. If we want to get our HIV rates down, we need to approach a treatment and prevention plan that targets every Australian. Dean Arcuri speaks to one of the authors of the article, James Ward, who is the head of infectious disease research at the South Australian Health and Medical Research Institute.
It could be an artefact of the data for the last 5 years, but I'm pretty confident that we've had such a strong focus on prevention and engagement with the new biomedical approaches to prevention in HIV in Australia that it has had a significant impact on the rate of diagnoses in the non-Aboriginal population, and we haven't had the same emphasis in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. So I think what's required is a bit of a shift in in our focus to try and get some better outcomes for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people with HIV. So the two big things I think that are really have been the game changers, I think particularly over the last 5 years, are the treatment as prevention kind of agenda, which is, about people getting to an undetectable viral level and reducing transmission risk. And then the other one is PrEP, obviously. And I think in both of those areas, we haven't done so well in engagement of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and we need to do much better. PrEP has really been rolled out in Australia in a trial environment, and more recently it's gone into implementation through normal pharmaceutical supply. And I think the messaging has been a bit slow to get to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities.
Do you think part of the problem isn't just that the messaging has been slow, but also the message hasn't necessarily been targeting those communities in the right way?
Yeah, so if you look at most of the PrEP trials around Australia, in most of the jurisdictions, a few of them are missing, but in most of the jurisdictions they've been focused around the large metropolitan centres like Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, and Queensland will argue that they've been up and down the East Coast. But for a lot of Aboriginal people, they more minority live in those larger centres, and there's a greater proportion of our population that live in regional areas as well as remote areas. And I think although the rates of diagnoses are low out in those areas, the messaging hasn't got out there in terms of PrEP. But also I think that we have a large proportion of our population who is living with HIV that are not engaged as well in care and on treatment and reaching undetectable viral load. And that's for a range of different reasons that we can only speculate, but we don't know for sure. And some of those reasons might be about medication overall and its approach, the Western approach to treatment of disease. Secondly, about access to care, about payments to financial barriers that might prohibit people from accessing treatment. It might be about people taking breaks from treatment, or it might be that people just not get engaged in HIV care after their diagnosis. So, you know, I think we've got a lot of work to do with some of the positive population in the Aboriginal community, for sure. And the other thing that we do know is, based on modelling, there's a greater proportion of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people living with HIV who are not yet diagnosed. And that's based on late diagnoses. It's kind of modelled on late diagnoses, number of notifications in different population priority groups, for instance, IDEU, people in drugs and heterosexual people. So we speculate that about 18% of people living with HIV who are Aboriginal are not yet diagnosed, and that compares to about 8% in the non-Aboriginal population. So it's kind of this three-way risk, I guess, that's probably contributing to these increases in HIV diagnoses that we're seeing in communities over the last 5 years.
In relation to the Indigenous communities, when you're looking at the data, was the level of HIV transmission specific to the men who have sex with men or heterosexual communities, or was this just a narrative that we really need to look at across the board?
Yeah, no, it's a very different epidemiological profile for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who are diagnosed with HIV compared to non-Aboriginal people. So in Australia, about just over 80% of the diagnoses that occur in non-Aboriginal populations occur among men who have sex with men. And for the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander population, it's just over 50%. So that means 46% of our diagnoses, really, are in heterosexual people. And that, between that 46%, about half of those diagnoses occur because of heterosexually acquired sex, and the other half occur because of people who inject drugs, heterosexual people who inject drugs. And so there are two very different risk groups there, and that's probably where a good example where the biomedical approaches are not reaching into the population enough. So PrEP currently is not reaching heterosexual people at risk, unless you've got a partner perhaps. And also people who inject drugs are not classified as a risk factor for PrEP, unless you've got a partner who's living with HIV and you're not. So that's a kind of a neat example of where we're not reaching populations. And because of this different epidemiological profile, these biomedical approaches are not impacting enough in our population.
It really does speak to the fact that when we've been combating this, we have really taken a Western approach to it. And it's really important for us to make sure that we're taking a whole effect when we're looking at the health of the entire of Australia's community, specifically the Indigenous community.
About 90% of the diagnoses of HIV that occur in Australia are among, firstly, non-Aboriginal people, and then among men who have sex with men, make up about 80% of the diagnoses in Australia. So it makes good sense to focus efforts in on MSM, but it shouldn't be at the cost of other populations who are at risk of HIV. And I guess the article that we published in MJA this week is really to try and make sure that we don't forget about these other populations at high risk of HIV, and that we put some effort into promotion of these new biomedical approaches, or these new advances in HIV prevention, to make sure that those populations benefit as much as the MSM population in Australia. It's not like one or other. I think everyone needs to have access to these biomedical approaches. And given that there are lots of socio-economic and cultural determinants that impact on HIV transmission in Aboriginal communities, it's even more reason why we need to divert some of our attention or put further effort into making sure that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities are not left behind in this area. We need to continue the more traditional methods of prevention of HIV, condoms, clean needles, education, awareness in communities. I think that shouldn't be dropped off the agenda because we've got new biomedical approaches. We should be really trying to increase our efforts in what's commonly known as combination prevention, which is, you know, the new biomedical approaches to HIV prevention alongside the traditional ones that have been rolled out for the last 30 years, which is condom use and needle syringe programs and so forth.
That was Dean Arcuri speaking with James Ward, head of the Infectious Disease Research at South Australian Health and Medical Research Institute.
There is still more to come on Joy's The Informer, the news program from an LGBTI perspective.
The Channel is a giving circle focused on advancing LGBTIQA+ causes through grant rounds. The grants give LGBTIQA+ community projects a chance to use their voice and tell their stories. Tonight, we speak to the Channel's Executive Director, Georgia Matthews, about their first ever small grants round, Diverse Storytelling, which will offer four grants of $2,500 each to standout projects that best support the LGBTIQA+ community. The winning applicants will be awarded for projects that are community-led and focus on marginalised groups and the issues that they face.
The Channel is a collective giving vehicle for the LGBTQI community in Australia. So we're the first LGBTQI plus giving circle in the country. The members sign up, make a monthly or annual donation, and we pool the funds and then together through a democratic decision-making process decide where to distribute those funds in the form of grants for LGBTQI plus community projects. Our latest funding opportunity, this is our fourth grant round and as our first small grants round. So the theme is diverse storytelling. So we've got a sort of a funny structure for some boring reasons. So we wanted to give our members who contribute to the pool of funds the option of getting a tax deduction for their giving or foregoing that tax deduction so that their giving could be more flexible. So we have two funds. One, you get a tax deduction and then we can only distribute those funds to tax deductible not-for-profit charities. Or if members choose to forego their tax deduction, we can distribute those funds to individuals, startups, random projects that are happening around the place. It's much more flexible. And we sort of wait until we've got sort of a critical mass of funding in any one of those pots, and then we run around to distribute that money. So the last couple of rounds, we've distributed some tax-deductible funds. So they've gone to more established organisations that have the infrastructure that allows them to accept that money. But this round is coming out of the non-tax-deductible pot. Often that means that small grants are sort of more suited to the sorts of opportunities that come through because they don't have to be organisations that don't have tax-deductible status. They can have it. But generally, this encourages individuals that have got a good idea but aren't able to access sort of traditional funding sources to come forward and apply for funds because there are very few requirements. So we thought we had about 10 grand in that pot this time around, and we thought it would be fun to do four grants of $2,500 for anybody who's got, you know, a really great sort of community project that they've been wanting to do or that needs a little bit of injection of funding to make it a success. We've funded a project that works with queer people that have had an out-of-home care experience to advocate for better servicing of their needs called Pride in Care. We've funded social change virtual reality documentary called A Clever Label, which exposes the detrimental effects the Australian Christian lobby have had on the LGBTQI plus community historically. Our most recent grant went to Northcote Innovation, which is a sort of human-centred research and design lab to do a project called Velvet Expressions, which explored the experiences of LGBTQI people with intellectual or physical disabilities accessing sexual pleasure and how design can assist them with those experiences. So that's our little portfolio.
When you're talking about the tax-deductible grants versus the ones that have a bit more breadth, is there a specific area that the funding needs to be spent on in relation to the project? And are there specific required outcomes of these projects?
Yeah, sure. Again, this is part of an educational and engagement process with our members. So I think that sometimes philanthropic funders can lean towards wanting to fund programmatic costs only, so wanting to fund the particular activity, the thing that leads to the particular outcome that's quantifiable, and they can point to that and they can say, I resourced that thing happening and therefore X occurred. But, you know, logically we all know that that's not how community work happens. There needs to be people that make the activities happen. There needs to be bills paid. There needs to be, you know, strategic planning that occurs, there needs to be professional development, et cetera, et cetera. So a big part of the conversations that we have with our members around, you know, what we want to be looking for in project proposals is capacity to deliver the project and thinking about the size of the grant that we're giving and whether we're setting people up for failure. So we really focus on, that's why we have listed that we're happy to fund sort of capital costs and operational spend and those sorts of things, because from our point of view, all of that contributes to the outcomes. Then in terms of being able to identify our impact, we, again, something that's so great about collective giving is that our memberships start at $25 a month, so that's $300 a year. And a lot of people, if they're giving at that level alone, they can't really justifiably ask the recipient of those funds to report back on exactly how they were spent. If they did, then that is all not-for-profits would do, report back on every sort of $100 donation that they received. But giving together and giving, say, $10,000 together, it actually is justifiable to sort of ask for evidence of impact of that money. And so, you know, I'm very conscious, and our members are very conscious of not overburdening recipients, but we do ask for a progress report at the six-month point and then an acquittal report at the 12-month mark. And we also encourage interaction and, you know, attendance at events and those sorts of things from the not-for-profit organisations, which is sort of a part of, one, people being able to see the impact of their funding, but two, you know, just that community building element and just bringing people from different walks of life together.
And Georgia, for these submissions, you're asking people to submit a short 2-minute video accompanied by some written questions. Does the video have to be done with professional equipment, or can it have more of a lo-fi approach?
Yeah, so because this is our first small grants round, we decided that we wanted the expression of interest submission process to be really quick and easy, because we realised that $2,500, you know, isn't really enough to justify filling out reams and reams of paperwork. So we're asking for a video under 2 minutes, as you say, and then just a couple of quick written responses to some questions. And we're really stressing in our guidelines that we don't want people to spend any money on editing or producing that video. We're really looking for lo-fi submissions that are shot on your phone. And that's because we think that quite quickly it can become an equalizer if we're, you know, allowing people to shoot things on fancy cameras and, you know, have the resources to put a lot of time and effort into their proposal, when really we just want your video to communicate really well what the project you want to do and to show a little bit of creativity. That's all you need to do.
What about for people who might not be sure if the project that they want to propose or their experience is enough to be able to step up and apply for a grant? Is there any advice for people who might be new to working in this sort of area?
Sure. My advice is that you definitely are not too inexperienced. That doesn't exist. We're looking for innovative projects that can come from anybody, anywhere. And when we say diverse storytelling, that's really what we mean. We're looking for people from all corners of the nation, from all backgrounds, especially people from marginalised LGBTIQ plus communities. We'll certainly be looking more favourably upon projects from different segments like that. And yeah, just give it a go. You know, you don't have anything to lose. And you could just get $2,500 to make something really cool happen. If you want to vote on where the funding goes, you can join as a member of the channel. As I said before, memberships start at $25 a month and everybody gets one vote no matter what you contribute. So get on board.
All right, that sounds great, Georgia. Is there anything else you'd like to say in terms of anything that usually stands out in past submissions that you'd be really looking out for this year?
I think strong submissions are one that have really thought through the community impact that they're going to have. So it is a requirement that the projects benefit the community and not just an individual. Ones that have been thought out well, and that if it is something that has got some evidence base around it, then understanding that and communicating the fact that we know it works is also really helpful.
That was Liv and myself speaking with Georgia Matthews from the channel. For more information, head to www.the-channel.org and go to their grants section to apply.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
We often look at drag as just a form of entertainment that happens as part of our culture and nightlife. But for many people, cross-dressing means something more and can help them accept who they truly are. For performer Madeline McKenzie, drag did just that. Starting off as a performance expression, she realised that the character on stage was who she truly was and accepted she was a transgender woman. This weekend, Madeline stepped back into the spotlight and returned to performing to her community, but as herself, and shares her experience with us on The Informer.
It's like a butterfly, you know? When the time is right and she's ready to come out, she'll come out. And it was just the perfect time for me, so I was ready.
I am what I am. I am my own special creation.
When Madeline McKenzie started performing in drag years ago, it was a space to be someone different, to stand in the spotlight and be a character and escape who she was.
I think it was international at that time, but it was for the Miss Gay Australia pageant. That was exhausting, but a lot of fun. But yeah, express who you are, but in a different form. And show you that sort of creative flair that I have within myself that's also quite humorous as well. And it's a bit of a stick to it.
Pretty soon she started performing her drag character all over the place.
For their community in their hometowns, like Geelong. This is like, you know, Geelong, Ballarat, Bendigo, oh gosh, East Gippsland in Traralgon, Morwell. It was fun. Just being able to, like, even though like we're all going through our own thing, but for everyone to like come together for that one night and just have fun, it was awesome.
But then Madeline realised that the real character she was putting on wasn't the character that was standing in the spotlight, but the one that was in the shadows. And as a transgender woman, she was actually exploring who she really was in a safe and inclusive space.
Makeup and even big, everything. But as I, you know, as we go through, you know, the formation of who we are as characters in drag, my character became less and less over the top and more softer and more subtle, and I became more comfortable with who I was and my character, and it became like the whole, oh yes, queen girl. I was just like, you know what? Towards the end, I was like, I was just being myself, and I was more comfortable, and I just didn't want to take it off. But as soon as I took it off, I could still see that character. I could still see that person, but in a different, it was like a different shape.
My world, and it's not a place I have to hide in.
To be able to just be myself and not care, but towards the end of it all, it was just like, you know what, I'm exhausted. I'm tired of pretending to be someone else that I'm not. And when I was doing drag, I was able to just let everything go and let my hair down and just be me. I mean, yes, it's the whole, you know, the queenie side of it all, but towards the end of it, when I said, all right, drag's not for me, but doing that and that side of it, in some sense, it is to me, because I didn't want to take it off, but I felt comfortable. Like, I don't know, it's hard to explain, but I'm happy.
I am what I am.
Realizing, you know, I had to learn to accept who I was. I had to, and I think the whole process of this transition of mine was learning for me, and it's still, I have to pound it in my head every day and say to myself, you know, learning to love myself was literally the hardest thing. The whole thing about this transition has been, I mean, I wasn't even ready for it, was the mental side of it all. Like, I'm very mentally stubborn, and I'm strong, and I've got thick skin, but it's like every day is a challenge, every single day. So I'm just like, you know what? I'm an impatient person at times, so I'm just like, all right, well, look, I can't rush my transition, because I want to look as natural and soft and feminine and untouched as possible, but still be possible at the same time. And I'm glad I didn't rush anything, because it worked out for me in the end.
This past weekend, Madeline came down from Adelaide to perform in Cancer is a Drag, the fundraiser. Now an annual event, where a massive night at the Pride of our Footscray, seeing a huge amount of talent perform, donating their time and craft to help raise much-needed money to support cancer research. But this time, Madeline wasn't performing in drag, but performing as herself, stepping back into the spotlight for the first time in 5 years.
Present myself in a way to my friends and to the world, with the costume, with the timing, and just, it's basically my story of who I was being that scene queen who thought they were all fierce and everything and bitchy, and just coming from that scene to going away and going through my transition into basically being a grown-ass person, like into something so much more beautiful. That scene that just shines with like so much light and energy, and it's just, I just had to figure out how I was gonna show that, you know, show who I was as a person, as an artist, after, especially, you know, doing Miss Transsexual Australia International 2018. I really stepped it up for myself. I really made a name for myself and impressed not only myself, but left a memorable impression with the girls about, you know, what I did for the competition. So doing the, it just, it's like everything seemed to happen for a reason during this transition, and the pageant came along, I did that, and I was like, okay, well, I've really raised the bar with my standards for myself. So now Cancer is Drag came along, and I went, this is perfect. Why not? I love Melbourne. Melbourne's my home. Yes, I live in Adelaide, but I love flying on a plane. Besides, it's only an hour, a snack and a drink and a blink of eyes, and you're there.
Cancer as a Drag raised $5,000 and was a huge success.
It's ridiculous. It went down the street and around the corner, and they were having to actually knock people back because they were at full capacity. So next year, they're going to do a bigger venue.
For Madeline, Cancer as a Drag was a chance to celebrate who she was today and bring a new dimension to what it means for her to perform for her community. She was very proud to be able to stand up and be herself. Madeline encourages everyone to reach out for support and find the community who accept you for who you are.
I've lost some friends this year, and it's hard. It's hard when you can be so isolated for so long and think that's okay when it's not. So my advice to anyone who's going through anything is, even if it's someone you don't know, talk to someone, because there's always going to be someone there that can help you, give you advice, or at least point you in the direction of, you know, so you can get some help.
That was Dina Curie with Madeline McKenzie after the Cancer is a Drag fundraiser this weekend.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.
And that's it for another episode of The Informer, bringing you news and current affairs for Australia's LGBTI communities. A podcast of tonight's Informer will be available to download soon at joy.org.au or on your preferred podcast platform. Don't forget to follow us on social media, at The Informer on Joy 94.9 on Facebook and at The Informer Joy on Twitter. If you have a story or tip you'd like to share with us, get in touch at theinformer@joy.org.au. You've been listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9. I'm Tom Morgan.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.